Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Bernie or Bust movement, which, in spite of Bernie Sanders' promise not to be another Ralph Nader, is vowing to vote for Sanders as a write-in candidate if he loses the nomination. Neil Schroeker, the Communications Director for Democracy for America, a grassroots political organization founded by Howard Dean that supports Bernie Sanders, joins us to discuss the challenge Sanders faces should he lose the nomination in convincing his passionate followers to vote for Hillary Clinton, and the People for Bernie movement that is forming to continue building the political revolution after the primaries are over. Then we'll speak with Ken Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He is the author of Big Money, $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. And we will discuss his latest article at Politico, Trump Campaign Brings in Lobbyists for Key Posts, and the clients who Trump's new convention chief, Paul Manafort, has serviced, which include the dictators Marcos and Mobutu, as well as the recently ousted Ukrainian kleptocrat Viktor Yanukovych. Then finally, we'll examine President Obama's visit to the UK and Germany and look into his upcoming meeting with European leaders and speak with Michael Brenner, a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. He is the author of Towards a More Independent Europe, and we will discuss Obama's efforts to shore up the NATO alliance, as well as his recent meetings at the Gulf Summit in Saudi Arabia, where the Saudis are apparently anxiously awaiting the Saudi Vision 2030 manifesto the new boy king, Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, is unveiling on Monday. And joining us now is Neil Schroeker, who is the Communications Director of Democracy for America. Previously, he was the Progressive Change Campaign's Committee Press Secretary, and he also ran social media projects for MoveOn.org and managed new media for Barack Obama's primary campaigns in South Carolina and Ohio. Welcome to Background Briefing, Neil Schroeker.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Neil, what do you make of the Bernie or Bust movement's determination to vote for him one way or the other, even if he doesn't get the nomination? They are apparently, and I've witnessed this myself, many of the supporters for Bernie Sanders are quite passionate. And it appears to be a problem for the candidate himself, who has vowed that he doesn't want to be another Ralph Nader, a spoiler. So how do you think Bernie's going to be able to navigate this if indeed he doesn't get the nomination?
Well, I think the first step for Bernie Sanders is to continue this strong run through the California primary and even the D.C. primary that happens, that kind of ends the process in mid-June. We've got more than a few months ahead of us. And listen, the path coming out of New York is brambled. It's certainly not clear. It's not going to be easy. It is technically possible, but it's going to be very difficult for him to win this nomination. But there is still a path. And you and I both know, and we were just talking about how excited and enthusiastic Bernie Sanders supporters are, and they need to know that we still have a fight to wage here, and we've got to go, no matter what happens on Tuesday, go and win as many delegates as possible to see if we can win the majority of pledged delegates when this process is over. But you're right. I think it's always a challenge when you've got supporters as passionate, as motivated, and frankly, as self-organizing as the supporters that Bernie Sanders has, to kind of bring them all on board when the process is over and make sure that we can all unite to defeat whatever bigot Republicans put up on the other side. And I think that's going to be a really unifying thing for Democrats and the folks that are supporting Bernie Sanders in the end, is that after all of this fight, I don't think any of us, I know I don't, and I think the majority of your listeners out there don't want to see Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or whatever, you know, like I said, bigot that Republicans put up winning this election after the incredibly strong campaign that Bernie Sanders has run.
But do you think, Neil, it'll be enough for Hillary Clinton to say, I'm not Donald Trump or I'm not Ted Cruz?
Well, here's the thing. I think that the movement behind Bernie Sanders We've accomplished a tremendous amount over the last year. Going forward, we're going to have to do, we're going to have to act like big kids and do a couple of different things. Number one, ensure that Donald Trump or Ted Cruz doesn't get into the White House. But number two, work like heck to make sure that, some of these populist progressive champions that have been supporting Bernie Sanders or have been supporting Bernie Sanders style, policies win their primaries in the months ahead and hopefully win general elections so that even if we can't get Bernie Sanders in the White House, we can get him more allies in the U.S. Senate and in the House and in state legislative chambers all across the country. Because if we have been talking, and I earnestly believe in the kind of political revolution that Bernie Sanders has been calling for, but if we want that revolution, we've got to have candidates running and winning office up and down the ballot, not just at the very tippy top. And so if we're not successful in getting in winning the presidential nomination, let's try and be successful and win a bunch of other races to ensure that nobody can ignore the kind of policies that Bernie Sanders has been pushing throughout this campaign.
And again, I'm speaking with Neil Sroka, who is the communications director of Democracy for America. Previously, he was the Progressive Change Campaign Committee's press secretary, and he also ran social media projects for MoveOn.org and managed new media for Barack Obama's primary campaigns in South Carolina and Ohio. And Neil, you mentioned you're sticking with Bernie all the way through, and even through the D.C. primary, which is sort of a footnote in a way.
A lot of people forget it.
I know, but there's another group that's formed as well called People for Bernie, and they're organizing a summit in somewhere. It's going to be in Chicago after the June. It'll be after the June 7th California primary, sometime in July in Chicago.
Yeah, I think it's going to be right after the DC primary. What I've heard is that they're talking June 16th and 17th, and it sounds like it's a great opportunity for folks who have been a part of this political revolution to get together and figure out what's next.
So what's your sense then of it seems like there's a movement after that's more or less acknowledged the possibility of him not becoming the nominee, People for Bernie, and then there's a movement before, which is ongoing, which is Bernie or bust, which is basically defiantly saying, it's Bernie or nothing. So
Here's the thing. I think that the people that are saying Bernie or bust are, and I don't want to impugn these folks because they're some of our staunchest allies in this fight to get Bernie Sanders the Democratic nomination. And so many of them have been brought into the process perhaps for the very first time or maybe brought back into a process they were disenchanted by earlier by Bernie Sanders' campaign. And it's frustrating to potentially do all this work, defy all the critics, and do something truly incredible that Bernie Sanders has done, and maybe not be successful in the end. We'll see. Listen, there's still many contests to go, and it may be Bernie or bust because he wins the nomination. But listen, all of us also remember 8 years ago, Secretary Clinton had a lot of hardcore supporters. There were the Pumas, Party Unity My Ass. Folks that were saying that they were never going to vote for Barack Obama. And listen, that group, at the end of the day, did not have a sizable impact on the Democratic Party. It did not have a sizable impact on how the general election went off. And at the end of the day, I think that this Bernie or Bust movement makes sense, and I understand the frustration now. I think it'll change, and hopefully the energy that could be put into this, Bernie or bust movement is shifted from just focusing on the presidential race to hopefully electing a slew of, Bernie Sanders style candidates to the House, the Senate, and state offices across the country. I get it. I think that people have the right to be frustrated with the kind of way we go about nominating presidential candidates, because it is opaque and it is the process is difficult and oftentimes seems tilted against grassroots activism. But we have to all commit ourselves to ensuring that Donald Trump and Ted Cruz do not get into the White House. The prospect there is just too dangerous for us to take our eye off the prize of preventing them their place and ensuring that Bernie Sanders actually can build on some of the power that he's, you know, and our movement has grown throughout this campaign.
And Neil, your organization's of which you're the communications director, Democracy for America, it's a grassroots political organization, was founded by Howard Dean, right?
Yeah, it was founded by Howard Dean. Interestingly, Howard Dean supported Secretary Clinton starting back in 2015. And DFA, we decided not to endorse for quite a long time. And then in December of this past year, we did what we've historically done and went to our members. We've got 1 million members across the country and said, you vote. Tell us what you want us to do. Which candidate do you want us to support? And with the caveat being, in order for us to endorse, we need to have 66%. We need to have a supermajority of our members voting to say we should endorse a candidate. And for the first time in DFA's 12-year history, Democracy for America members voted 87% to endorse Bernie Sanders. And that's why we've gone all in supporting him throughout this campaign, whether it's raising him over $1.5 million from DFA members, working closely with the campaign to help train volunteers. If you've been learning how to make phone calls or use text messaging tools to bring people into the political process, you were most likely trained through a process that DFA helped the campaign set up. And doing a lot of media work with the campaign as well, getting his back when the DNC threatened to shut down his campaign for a few days because of a failure of the back end of a database system, or making sure that folks knew that it's unacceptable to be attacking Bernie Sanders' strong support of the auto bailout during the Michigan primary. So we've been a real staunch ally of Bernie Sanders throughout this campaign. And frankly, we're going to be fighting with him till the very end of this process to make sure he gets as many delegates as humanly possible going into the convention in Philadelphia.
And when you mentioned, Neil, the database, of course, Howard Dean, in his 2004 presidential campaign, generated a substantial database, which I guess your organization, Democracy for America, inherited. Apparently, there's a lot of I was going to say vultures circling, but whatever it is, there's an awful lot of people that want to get a hold of Bernie Sanders' database. Is that your understanding?
There was a Politico reporter that came out. I guess it was talking to some consultants that really want access to this database, and I hope and that people learn that the supporters that are getting Bernie Sanders emails and are contributing, you know, $27 a pop, or getting on the phones and making or knocking on doors for Bernie Sanders, these are some of the most dedicated grassroots activists, and they're supporting Bernie Sanders not just because he's some other Democrat. They're supporting him for a very specific policy vision that he has for this country. And I hope that whatever happens in the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders supporters work together, perhaps through a Bernie Sanders, a subsequent organization, perhaps through organizations like DFA. And we work to empower candidates that are supporting the populist progressive vision that Bernie Sanders has been running on throughout this campaign. Too often in Democratic politics, progressive activists, folks that make the phone calls, make the small dollar contributions, do a lot of the heavy lifting of campaigns, we're just treated like an ATM on these email lists, that we're just an email list that you blast out and we'll give you some money no matter what you say. That's not true. Our movement isn't an ATM. Our movement is trying to deliver a fundamental transformation to this country. And I hope sincerely that Bernie Sanders, whatever he decides to do on this campaign, whatever happens next, uses the power that he's built to continue growing and building power for the progressive movement, and not just any old Democratic candidate that comes a-knocking.
But just in closing, though, Neil Schroeker, yeah. the fundamental differences I see between Democrats and Republicans, and particularly the more progressive Democrats, is that you could make the critique that they, in many ways, would prefer to be righteous than effective, that they're very, very sure about their who they believe in, and it's either that person or nobody. And the Republicans on the other side seem to be more pragmatic and somewhat ruthless. I mean, if you want to get a difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, I would say watch that HBO movie Confirmation about Anita Hill versus Clarence Thomas, which makes it really clear that the Republicans were absolutely ruthless. They just wanted to get this guy on the court. They didn't care whether he was right or wrong. They were going to put him on the court. Whereas the Democrats, led by Joe Biden, were equivocating, and eventually they chickened out. And the result is that you've got Thomas on the court. So how do you address that critique?
Well, listen, I think, well, number one, I think you're seeing the Republican Party, I think that may historically have some truth. I think right now you're seeing that all cave in as the Republican Party seemingly marches towards nominating one of the most divisive political figures our country has seen in a very, very long time in Donald Trump. I think they may be going on this like a kind of topsy-turvy righteous trail right now and marching themselves right off the cliff. But the other thing is I think that the populist progressive, this we call it the Warren wing or the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, is growing. And it is increasingly the leading wing of the Democratic Party. I think we're at a point, and we may closely be getting to the point, where we can have our cake and eat it too, where we can stand for righteous policies, but also make sure that those policies get in there and actually have a chance of getting through Congress. You know, one of the really amazing things that has happened over the last couple of years, just 3 years ago, President Obama put cuts to Social Security in his budget that he was proposing to Congress. The progressive base of the party stood up, reacted, said hell no. And not only did we say hell no to that, to cuts to Social Security, but we've actually, over the course of 3 years, changed it so that the majority of Democrats in the U.S. Senate are supporting Social Security expansion. Bernie Sanders has run this incredibly powerful campaign calling for Social Security expansion. And even Secretary Clinton has been calling for a certain amount of Social Security expansion in what she's been calling for on the campaign trail.
Sure.
So we have the ability to change things in a meaningful way in the Democratic Party, and that speaks to progressive power.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Neil Schroeker.
Happy to do it.
And again, I've been speaking with Neil Schroeker, who is the communications director of Democracy for America. Previously, he was the Progressive Change Campaign Committee's press secretary, and he also ran social media projects for MoveOn.org and managed new media for Barack Obama's primary campaigns in South Carolina and Ohio. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Politico's chief investigative reporter about his latest article, Trump Campaign Brings in Lobbyists for Key Posts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kenneth Vogel, who's the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small town cop cop shops and school boards to state houses, congresses, and presidential campaign trail traveling during the 2008 campaign with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. He's the author of Big Money, $2.5 million, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. And his latest article at Politico is Trump Campaign Brings in Lobbyists for Key Posts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken Vogel.
Hey, and it's great to be back with you.
Well, thanks, Ken. And your latest article, it's to some extent, reveals the background of Trump's new convention chief, Paul Manafort's, at least in terms of the clients he serviced with his very prominent public relations firm in Washington. I think it's one of the biggest, isn't it?
Yeah, he for years was a top lobbyist in Washington, but In recent years, he sort of made his niche around the world, representing a range of clients, who some of whom have sort of less than savory backgrounds, and who at times have been referred to as, quote, the torturer's lobby. So he's represented Ferdinand Marcos. He represented Mobutu and Zaire, the Angolan guerrilla Jonas Savina, as well as a front group for Pakistani intelligence. And then most recently was representing Viktor Yanukovych, who, of course, was ousted as Prime Minister of Ukraine after allegations that he was essentially plundering the national reserves there. So Paul Manafort has not really been on the scene for quite a few years in Washington. And nonetheless, he was tapped to run, essentially, Donald Trump's presidential campaign and has brought in a number of folks with whom he worked in this sort of lucrative sideline between Washington GOP politics and international politics. And these folks also don't have a ton of recent presidential campaign experience, and even more than that, are being seen as kind of undercutting Donald Trump's message, that being that he is not beholden to the special interests and the lobbyists, and he doesn't play this insider political game. A little tougher to argue that when you have folks like Paul Manafort and his cronies running your campaign.
Well, in the case of the recently ousted Ukrainian kleptocrat Viktor Yanukovych, once he was fled to Moscow, the cameras went into this incredible palace in this impoverished, bankrupt country. And you saw the lavish way that this fellow and his family lived. So presumably Manafort was well compensated, shall we say.
Yeah, and that it's much more difficult track the money. For all the hand-wringing that we do about U.S. campaign finance laws and the lack of disclosure around campaign finances in the United States, we have far better campaign finance disclosure than almost any other country on earth. So good luck tracking the riches that Eastern European oligarchs or kleptocrats are raising during their time in office and for their political campaigns. There's no way to know how much Paul Manafort made from those campaigns. I will tell you, though, that we wrote some stories at the time because, in fact, there were a number of prominent U.S. political consultants who were working in Ukraine during those elections after 2010. And we, so I developed some sources in Ukraine, Ukrainian politics. And when, as you mentioned, Yanukovych was ousted in front of Moscow, and there was this realization all of a sudden about the riches that he had amassed and his lavish lifestyle that he was living in this palace, I had a source who called me up who was one of the journalists who went into the palace and found Paul Manafort's business card sitting on a desk in there. So that was just one indication of just how close Paul Manafort was to Yanukovych, despite his efforts now to reframe it as, well, Yanukovych at the time was regarded as the U.S. best friend in Ukraine, and that was, to my knowledge, was never the case, but certainly he came to be seen as really an enemy of the West and an ally of Moscow. And so Manafort continued to represent him well after it was sort of widely seen that he was no friend of the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Ken Vogel, who's the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He's the author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. And his latest article at Politico is Trump Campaign Brings in Lobbyists for Key Posts. In terms of your recent book, Ken, $2.5 billion, that's half of what they're going to be spending right this year. Talk about inflation.
Yeah, well, what's so interesting, of course, Ian, is that despite the fact that, as I argue in my book and continue to believe, that big money is playing a greater and a greater role in American politics, you have a real anomaly in Donald Trump, who is neither spending that much of his own money nor raising substantial sums from donors for his campaign. And he has nonetheless defied convention and mounted a really sort of unprecedented, novel social media and large campaign rally-driven campaign bid that is on the precipice of seizing the Republican Party nomination. And I do think that if he is the nominee, that there will be a lot more spending either on his behalf or by him in the general election. But to this date, he has spent just a fraction of what Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders has spent, even less than Ted Cruz has spent on his campaign, and has nonetheless been able to dominate in terms of free media, that is media coverage and through social media, in a way that I don't think a lot of us expected would be possible in this sort of post-Citizens United big money era.
And what's interesting, I think, Ken, is that Trump managed to knock off all of the other, most of the other 16 that ran against him, some of whom were spending hundreds of millions like Jeb Bush. And my understanding is that that all of the big Republican donors are feeling a pretty bit burned by now. You know, they've wasted a lot of money on people who didn't make it, whereas this other guy has been who's been trashing them as getting all this free media. So do they feel like chumps?
Yeah, but, you know, it's not new that they would necessarily feel that their money was wasted and wasn't spent most effectively. I mean, some of the folks whose names we bandy about, like, say, Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul, let's not forget, in the last presidential election, he spent $20 million trying to boost Newt Gingrich's woebegone bid for the Republican presidential nomination. The rate of return on that, obviously, is zero, or less than zero, because he came up looking like a real clown in all of it. It's not new that some of these people would be questioning how their money is being spent. What's new is that the spending is no one is seeing a sort of positive rate of return on their investment. So, in other words, you know, Sheldon Adelson could say, well, I spent all this money supporting Newt Gingrich, but Mitt Romney had even more money behind him. So Mitt Romney won, and that's sort of understandable. Now, of course, Mitt Romney ultimately lost to Barack Obama in 2012, but despite the fact that Adelson and the Koch brothers and other major Republican Party donors ended up spending a ton of money on behalf of Mitt Romney. But again, Barack Obama spent a lot of money as well. So in this sort of lopsided scenario that you have right now, all these rivals to Trump spent a ton of money, as that they're the supportive billionaire donors, and they were beaten by a guy who is not spending that much money. So it really does call into question whether some of the perceptions about how money would shape politics in the age of Citizens United, how some of those reform, it really calls into question some of our thinking on big money in politics.
Well, you pointed out a little while ago, Ken Vogel, that Manafort and all these lobbyists sort of fly in the face of a big part of Trump's appeal to the people who are flocking to his banner, and that is that he's not an insider and he's talks about the corruption in Washington and the lobbyists, etc., in the most derisive ways. And yet now he's got all these top lobbyists running for him. And already when Paul Manafort assured members of the Republican National Committee on Thursday down in Florida that Trump was going to reshape his image and essentially tone himself down, apparently that just infuriated Trump. So there's two questions. One is, how did Manafort get recorded? I mean, I think NBC got hold of it. That seems like something that wasn't desirable to have a recording of what he said. And two, is it true that Trump was furious? Because on the campaign trail, Trump has been anything but his boisterous self.
Yeah, I think that his comments and the recorded comments and that them being widely disseminated and being raised as a suggestion that Donald Trump is putting on an act in his reach and his outreach to voters and some of his campaign trail rhetoric, I think that is potentially more problematic for Trump than just bringing in lobbyists to run the campaign. It's this idea that these lobbyists are coming in and they're trying to get him to adhere to a more conventional political campaign playbook, to be more of a sort of conventional politician, whereas Donald Trump's appeal has very much been about being, you know, speaking his mind and not being a politician, and then secondarily, not being beholden to the special interests and the lobbyists and the like. So with Paul Manafort, you sort of have a twofer where he's undercutting Trump's message on two key tenets of his candidacy. And yes, my understanding is that Trump was not happy with this at all. And you see a real tension. I think the tension is playing out certainly most obviously in the power struggle atop Donald Trump's campaign between Paul Manafort, who, while his title is convention manager, he's basically the top strategist, and then the guy who had run the campaign until Manafort took over late last month, Corey Lewandowski, who's a much less experienced, sort of more of an anti-establishment operative. He had worked for the Koch brothers. He had worked for a number of anti-establishment conservative politicians. And his motto and the sort of guiding principle when he was running the campaign was let Trump be Trump, which interestingly is actually taken from a West Wing episode, the great NBC sitcom starring Martin Sheen as President Bartlet. Let Bartlet be Bartlet. But nonetheless, the sense was among Trump supporters that that approach had gotten them to a certain point, gotten them to the sort of precipice of the nomination. But in order to take it to that next level and actually nail down the nomination before the convention, you needed someone who sort of played the game in a more conventional way. In comes Manafort, and you see him undercutting, whether intentionally or otherwise, some of the things that got Trump this far.
So just in the last minute or so then, Ken Vogel, just returning to your article at Politico, Trump campaign brings in lobbyists for key posts. We talked a little bit about Manafort's, some of his clients that he serviced, the Filipino dictator Ferdinand Marcos and Zaire's Zeke Mobutu, and also a group of front people for the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence. And of course, the old joke about Pakistan is it's not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And then, of course, the recently ousted Ukrainian Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. The other people that you mentioned, though, that have come on board to join Trump with Manafort, Lawrence Gay and Rick Gates, they also bring a lot of baggage with them, too, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, Gay played an integral role in one of Manafort's sort of early brushes with infamy. That is an effort to win HUD contracts. These are federal contracts for the Housing and Urban Development Department. And this guy, Lawrence Gay, well, Manafort hired him to work for Manafort's firm because Gay had just recently, at the time in the 80s, been an official at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And one of their early efforts, Gay was found by a congressional subcommittee, investigative subcommittee, to have inappropriately essentially bribed an official who he knew from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And they dragged Manafort to testify before this congressional subcommittee. And he had sort of an infamous quote at the time when they asked him, like, is this influence peddling? And he said, the technical term for what we do in law firms, associations, and professional groups do is lobby, Manafort told them. But he said, for the purpose of today, I will stipulate that in a narrow sense, some people may term it influence peddling. So you sort of hear the euphemism coming through there. So that's Gay. There's another guy by the name of Doug Davenport who had lobbied, actually worked for Manafort's firm in the run-up to the 2008 presidential election, which lobbied or did government relations work for the Burmese military junta. And that work was seen as so toxic that while Davenport briefly was offered a job, like a key job in John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign, when that work came out, when there was a story published about that, he ended up resigning under pressure. So you have this type of work that John McCain, who is sort of an inside creature of Washington, has deemed to be a bridge too far. Nonetheless, Donald Trump, who cast himself as an anti-establishment candidate, is hiring that same guy to do something potentially more influential than what McCain had him doing.
Well, but, you know, I don't think that maybe there's not a lot of difference as much as these characters may be causing Trump some problems with his base now, because it seems hypocritical that he's been castigating lobbyists and Washington insiders on the campaign trail and now is hiring a bunch of them. One of the first things that Trump did after he insulted the Mexicans, he had a photo op at Trump Tower where, in order to sort of burnish his foreign policy chops, he introduced the press to this fellow from Indonesia who's a bag man for General Prabowo, who's a relative of the Suharto kleptocratic clan that stole 30, 40 billion from the Indonesian people. And he introduces this guy to sort of say, you know, I can make deals. So isn't Trump sort of like, I mean, he's a different kind of character in terms of foreign policy. He sees foreign policy, as much as we know, and what he knows, which is precious little, is just, you know, let's make a deal. You know, let's make a deal with Putin. Let's make a deal with anybody. And so is this, in other words, I'm saying that maybe Manafort and company aren't too far afield from Trump himself.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility, except they did it, you know, in this sort of quasi-public lobbying sector that Trump has eschewed. I mean, Trump has said that he played the game, played the game of government and played the game of donations and even hired lobbyists back in the day because he was a businessman. He was trying to get things done. Well, these are not folks who are necessarily they are in the private sector to the extent that they have out their own shingle and that they're receiving contract money from, from these different foreign regimes and also from, you know, U.S. based interests. But nonetheless, I think just to sort of play devil's advocate, I think that he could, a critic could rightfully say that that is something different, that that is not like the private sector that is sort of benefiting from the government and the government military lobbying industrial complex in a way that is different from the work that Trump did as a businessman interfacing with government.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Ken Vogel.
Pleasure.
Thank you again, Ken. And I've been speaking with Ken Vogel, who's the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money and politics. He is the author of Big Money, $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle and a Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. And his latest article at Politico is Trump Campaign brings in lobbyists for key posts. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining President Obama's visit to the UK and Germany, and we'll be looking into his upcoming meeting with European leaders on Monday. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Brenner, Professor of International Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a contributor to research and consulting projects on the Euro-American security and economic issues. A consultant to the United States Departments of Defense and State, he's the author of numerous books, including most recently, Towards a More Independent Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Brenner.
Pleased to be with you again, Ian.
And President Obama has been in the UK, where he's tried to rescue David Cameron's Irons from the Fire of Cameron's own creation by calling for a referendum that whether or not the UK should stay in the EU, which is a massive self-inflicted political wound that could end up being a catastrophe. And now he's in Germany, and then on Monday he meets with the European leaders. So what is he expected to do? I mean, he's curiously enough, he seems to be much more popular. He certainly is more popular in the UK than Cameron is. But telling the Europeans that they've got to, you know, stiffen their spine and spend more on NATO, that might be a hard sell.
Well, that's been an American line for the last sort of 30, 40 years. And seemingly, you know, transitory events like the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War haven't had a sort of dramatic effect in terms of sort of, you know, suspending that line. Now the point of anxiety and negative reference, of course, is the Middle East, and also this sort of exaggerated image, the portrayal of Russia as a prospective security threat, none of which, I mean, the latter, of course, really is not grounded in reality. It has to do more with this sort of, you know, symbolism and American domestic politics than it has with what's happening in Russia or the Ukraine and in Eastern Europe generally. But we can put this in context insofar as the United States has had one sort of consistent, sort of principled strategic concern about Europe since the end of the Cold War. And that is that sort of Europe achieved some measure of unity, but not enough unity so that it might think and act independently and autonomously in international affairs. In other words, the United States and successive American administrations have wanted to keep Western Europe and now most of the continent subordinate to the United States. And, of course, that's been made easier. It's been facilitated by the inability of the Europeans to concert themselves and to generate the political will to assume a significant role on the world stage. And so what it boils down to is, one, the United States wants Europe to be an auxiliary and a contributor to its sort of, you know, broad strategic, achieving its broad strategic objectives in the world, but very much in a secondary role. Britain's presence in the European Union serves that end because of Britain's basic followership, as the French would say, or sort of obedience to or agreement with American designs and most individual American initiatives, and therefore via Britain, the United States has a permanent lever of influence within the European Union. That's why Obama essentially has gone out of his way to insert himself into the British debate, and also calculated in the belief that his and the United States' sort of saliency in the British public mind outweighs and will outweigh any resentment about a foreigner and another country immersing itself in what should be a British domestic decision.
Well, nevertheless, though, the EU is the largest economic bloc in the world, and that's what's so strange about the British possibly even pulling out, even though Cameron obviously regrets approving the referendum in the first place. And, of course, President Obama is calling for a U.S.-EU trade pact.
Right, right. Well, of course, first let's make the connection to the point that we were just discussing. I mean, what the United States succeeded in doing, when you look at it in broad historical perspective or global perspective is that it has diplomatically, politically neutralized what is the strongest economic unit in the world, which is the European Union. Has been able to neutralize it, not because of any particular exercise of coercive measures, but because of a lack of any political will existing in Europe. Second, the United States' main economic interest in the European Union has been to maintain the European Union, I mean, its sort of leading members, as adherence to the U.S. conception as to how the global economy should be organized and the principles that should govern it. And those are essentially the principles that are the sustain the neoliberal vision of the world. Free movement of goods, free movement especially of capital, accepting the what's in effect is the financialization of the world economy. Because let's remember that on the world stage now, the United States' economic strengths are in finance and in high tech rather than in manufacturing. So for the United States, a completely sort of open world economy, if we can call it that, is very much sort of to its interest. And since Britain and most especially the Cameron government has signed on with conviction to the same formula, this reinforces the interest of the United States in having Britain continue to be an influential presence in the European Union.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Brenner, who's Professor of International Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, a Senior Fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a contributor to research and consulting projects on Euro-American security and economic issues. A consultant to the United States Departments of Defense and State, he's the author of numerous books, including most recently, Towards a More Independent Europe. So, in terms of the first leg of Obama's trip was to the Gulf Cooperative Council's summit meeting in Saudi Arabia, where there was nobody from the royal Saudi royals, the Al Saud family, to greet him at the airport in a very clearly designed slight insult, whatever they and then you know he had the summit, of course. And now we learn that all of Saudi Arabia is on waiting with bated breath for the Monday's unveiling of a manifesto by the Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, otherwise known as the Kid or the Boy, who's effectively running the kingdom. He's unveiling this new, it's called Saudi Vision 2030, which is supposed to be a roadmap for where Saudi Arabia goes in the future, because it only has essentially one resource, oil, and that they've managed to lower the price on, which is itself a bit of a puzzlement for a lot of people. But on top of that, you know, they made no efforts to diversify, really. The aquifer is drying up. They have nothing but problems, and they seem to be run at this moment by this spoiled brat who's just making mistake after mistake.
Yeah. Well, you have two. Well, let's say, I mean, there are two ways to look at what's happening in Saudi Arabia. One is structural, and the other having to do with personalities. Structurally, the main shock to the Saudi Arabia was the Arab Spring and its repercussions. Anyway, the Saudis, who have always been, or the Saudi royal family, who have always been very level-headed, very cool, managed their external relations with great skill, despite the peculiarities of their regime and their circumstances, really went off the rails. And they went off the rails because they sort of saw a convergence of a number of threats to the legitimacy. And let's keep in mind that anxiety about the royal family's legitimacy is the pivot to everything the Saudi government does and everything it's worried about. And the things that threaten it range from democracy and the principle of popular sovereignty to being outflanked on the fundamentalist end of the Islamist continuum by groups like ISIL. And three is a challenge from Iran-led sort of Shia sect of Islam to Sunnis, Saudi-led sort of dominance of certainly the Middle East, if not the Islamic world generally. And they saw all of these three sort of coming together over the past few years, prompted in part by the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq that replaced a secular but Sunni-based government of Saddam Hussein with a Shiite government. And then Egypt, because in Egypt you had the worst of all worlds from the Saudi perspective, elections that freely brought to power the Muslim Brotherhood that has had very tenuous relations with the royal family, and a Muslim Brotherhood that was seen as a threat to sort of Saudi dominance within the sort of Sunni world. Those are the structural elements. And then in the midst of this, you have the rival in power after the death of King Abdullah of a new faction of the royal family. And these factions are all based on you know, a birth mother, the several wives going back to the first founder, King Saud. And the faction represented by the current king and his son Mohammed takes a rather different tack than their predecessors. The current king is suffering from Alzheimer. He has conferred on his son, this kid Mohammed, extraordinary powers, and he's trying to set up a line of succession that would ensure that his branch of the family, beginning with this Mohammed, will sort of forever rule Saudi Arabia. And this guy Mohammed has some very radical ideas. One, he wants Saudi Arabia to assert itself more aggressively in the region. That has led to this ill-considered attack on Yemen and the largest group in Yemen, the Houthis. It has led to his taking a very hostile stance to Iran. It has led to his Saudi Arabia sort of support sub rosa for al-Qaeda in Syria, known as al-Nusra, and turning a blind eye to financial support from Saudi sources for the Islamic State as well. This has to do again with this, two obsessions. One, you have to show yourself more orthodox and fundamentalist than anybody else to reinforce your claims to legitimacy as custodians of the holy sites of Mecca and Medina. And two, you prove your worth in part by defending the Sunni cause or advancing the Sunni cause against the Shiites, which is how they interpret everything happening in Syria, everything happening in Iraq, everything happening in Yemen. And then, as you mentioned, Mohammed also has some bizarre ideas for remaking the Saudi economy. Most people who really know the situation in Saudi Arabia have concluded neither his diplomatic vision nor his economic vision are credible. And so we can expect a lot of turbulence in Saudi Arabia and a lot of continuing static in the Saudi-American relationship, even though Obama has done everything he could to sort of appease the Saudis and never really stands up to them even when they do things like supporting the Islamic State, which are anathema to American interests.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Michael Brenner, in a recent article of yours, you basically said the complexity of the dilemmas that the White House has created for itself is further exacerbated by the dismaying truth that most of the main actors in the area we're talking about here are either emotionally unbalanced or monomaniacal fantasists. Al-Baghdadi of the Islamic State, the Salmans, father and son that we're talking about, the Saudi leaders, Erdogan in Turkey and Netanyahu in Israel. And the most level-headed and reasoned is Putin, whom Obama shuns in the conviction that a new Cold War is inescapable. Having designed a field of action sown with mines and offering no escape hatches, the temptation to temporize until retirement day may be irresistible. So you don't sound like much of a fan of Obama's, and you think he should call or he should start speaking truth about this character, all these crazy characters he's dealing with?
Well, yes. Well, Obama has a sort of odd character trait. In that, despite his strong sort of superiority complex, he always has referred to himself as the smartest guy in the room, the best negotiator, whatever. There is also another streak of insecurity in the man. And when you think about it, every time he's faced with a very strong-willed actor, whether domestically or abroad, he will not confront him, whether it's Big Pharma, the Wall Street barons, Republican leadership in Congress, and abroad, Netanyahu, and the ones you mentioned. And so there's a combination in his case of both what I would see as a personality weakness, and also an intellectual flaw in not realizing how much he is costing the United States by allowing himself to be blunt about being pushed around by people like Erdogan, by the Saudi royal family, and by Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu came to the U.S. and humiliated him and his own capital, and Obama did nothing, really. But this is very, very serious because the multiple jams we're in the Middle East stem in good part because of certain, fundamental misconceptions we have. And those misconceptions, in turn, have much to do in seeing people like Erdogan and the Saudis as our partners, when in fact their ambitions and their interests diverge from what American interests are. And whoever replaces Obama is going to have to face up to this or continue to suffer the consequences. Hillary Clinton has given no indication of disagreeing with any of these what I consider to be mistaken assumptions which have underlain American policy in the Middle East.
Well, Michael Brenner, I thank you very much for joining us.
Pleased to be with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Brenner, a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a consultant to the United States Departments of Defense and States, and the author of numerous books, including most recently, Towards a More Independent Europe. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.